Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics, the usual two segments up today. First, in a little while, we'll talk with Kurt Ellis, who is one of the people behind a film called Big River, a sequel to, or companion to, King Corn, both of which are very fine documentaries on the very sick American agricultural system. Sick and sickening American agricultural system. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined in the studio by Joel Shalit, who's been on this show quite a few times over the years. He has a new book out from Akashic Books called Israel versus Utopia. We will talk to Joel about the contradictions of within Israel and the Israel-U.S. relationship and the left's relation to Israel and all kinds of issues like that. But before we get to the interviews, some words on the economic news. I've complained for many years, usually with little support, that U.S. housing policy has long skewed too far in the direction of subsidizing homeownership. One of the many reasons that we've been in a financial and economic crisis for the last couple of years is that the government encouraged people to stretch too far to buy houses they couldn't really afford. That policy message was reinforced by frequent evocations of the virtues of homeownership throughout the culture. When the bust happened, people like me hoped that the government would move away from subsidizing purchase and start giving renters at least an even break. Well, as with many things about this crisis, instead of striking out new directions, the authorities have doubled down their bets on the status quo. A new report from the Congressional Budget Office put some numbers on this. This fiscal year, which closed on September 30th, Washington devoted four times the budgetary resources to ownership than it did to renting. $230 billion in spending and tax breaks for homeowners compared to $60 billion for renting. At 4-to-1, that's, again, about a 4-to-1 ratio. But only about twice as many Americans own rather than rent. And since owners are usually better off than renters, this ratio is especially back-asswards, as Sarah Palin might say. Worse, most of the government's support for homeownership used to come in the form of tax breaks, like the mortgage interest deduction, rather than direct spending. Not so recently. Now the direct spending, mainly various attempts to bail out a housing market that is in desperate straits, has skyrocketed. There's a $75 billion loan modification scheme to help troubled borrowers and gobs of taxpayer money thrown to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to keep them afloat. And Washington is also shipping money to state housing finance agencies to help at the more local level. The Obama administration had promised a fresh look at the skew towards ownership, but they're doing just the opposite for now. Speaking of housing, the Mortgage Bankers Association released its third quarter delinquency and foreclosure stats on Thursday morning. Most measures set another round of records, and most of those by comfortable margins. In the third quarter, 9.6% of borrowers, almost 1 in 10, were 30 or more days behind in their mortgage payments. Before the recent crisis, that figure had never gotten above 6%. Almost half the delinquents were 90 days or more behind, meaning on the verge of foreclosure. Foreclosures were started on 1.4% of all outstanding mortgages. That's almost three times the record before this crisis phase that began a couple of years ago. Translating those percentages into numbers, well over 11 million Americans live in housing that's behind to some degree, and over 5 million are in foreclosure. Since housing troubles usually last beyond the peak in unemployment, and since we're probably 6 or 10 months away from a peak in unemployment, it's virtually certain that things are going to get worse for at least a year, and perhaps more. Fresh news on the financial regulation front. Efforts in Congress to cap credit card interest rates are failing because of opposition from many Democrats and because of the lack of any meaningful support from the White House, Michael Cranish writes in a very informative piece in the Boston Globe. During the campaign, Obama supported the idea of a strict limit on credit card interest rates, but now safely in office, he's changed his mind. His vice president once represented Delaware, home to many bank credit card operations, and Biden was long known for carrying water for the industry. During his 25-year Senate career, his top campaign contributor was MBNA, a Delaware-based credit card issuer that was bought by Bank of America in 2005. Last May, almost half the Democratic Senate delegation voted with Republicans to block an effort sponsored by Bernie Sanders to cap credit card interest rates at 15%. Since that vote, banks have been aggressively raising rates to beat a new requirement taking effect in February that will require them, and this is onerous, isn't it, to give 45-day notice of rate increases. Banks and their higher congressional hands argue that they need high interest rates because the business is very labor-intensive, which is pretty funny, and faces high default risk. This is nonsense. In good times, banks make enormous profits on credit cards. They were about twice as profitable as their other lines of business during the fat years of several years ago. They are having some trouble with people falling behind in their bills today because of the recession, but it's still a pretty good business. Banks can borrow the money they lend to their credit card customers for under 5%. The average interest rate on credit cards is now around 14%. If they can't make money on that 9-point spread, then they're lending to the wrong people. If banks need interest rates above levels that once were associated with brass knuckle and baseball bat collection techniques, then the whole business needs a rethink. Too much credit card lending is to people who are in way over their heads, and it would be a mercy to the indebted to put an end to this sort of thing. In a lot of cases, easy credit card borrowing takes the political pressure off for higher wages and a more generous welfare state. Finally, our president told Fox News, of all people, on Wednesday that we've got to get our deficit under control or we'll face a double-dip recession. This is alarming. I don't agree with a lot of liberals and populists that deficits and debts are harmless. As federal indebtedness rises, interest payments will take up a larger portion of federal spending, and those interest payments go to rich bondholders, meaning they represent an upward redistribution of income over the longer term. High debt levels will greatly reduce future freedom for maneuver should another deep recession require another strong dose of fiscal stimulus. But these are all longer-term concerns, not occasions for immediate panic. The immediate task is keeping the economy from sinking back into crisis. Back in 1937, anxiety about deficits and inflation led the Roosevelt administration to cut back on spending and the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates. The result was a prompt relapse of depression, undoing 4 years of recovery. Obama's economists have repeatedly said that they've got 1937 in mind and don't want to repeat that mistake of a premature return to orthodoxy. But you can watch a hawkish consensus already developing. Maybe Obama doesn't really mean what he said, and he's just throwing the orthodox a bone. But given what we've seen of his conservative streak, I'm not so sure. Of course, the borrowing will have to be scaled back someday. It's just way too early to be thinking and talking like this. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about poisonous agriculture.
I'm standing on the stage. I'm working in.
And that was some of the Brian Eno and David Byrne song, The River, from the album they did last year, Everything That Happens Will Happen Today, which seems unlikely, even if it's just an album title. We're down joined in the studio by Kurt Ellis, who is one of the creators of a film called Big River, which is a sequel or a companion, you're calling it, to King Korn, which came out a while back. And we interviewed you back then. But you're calling it a sequel or a companion, Kurt Ellis?
Well, thanks for having me. It's dangerous to call something a documentary sequel. So we've chosen the word companion instead, but it's probably something for the dictionary experts to look into and get back to us.
But it did come after in time. So, so first of all, just tell us about King Korn. People's memories may have faded over the last couple of years.
Sure. King Korn is a feature documentary that I made with my cousin Aaron Wolf behind the camera as director and my best friend from college, Ian Chaney, with me in the film, along with experts including Michael Pollan and Walter Willett, the chair of the Harvard Department of Nutrition. The goal of King Korn was to follow 1 acre of corn into America's food. And Ian and I graduated from college on the East Coast and moved to a place we'd never spent any time, which is Iowa, and planted and grew 1 acre of fairly typical industrial American field corn. And then we set out from our farm in the heartland to try to see where our corn was going to wind up as it became food.
And that corn that you grew is basically inedible by humans, right?
Directly, right. The corn we grew was really meant to be a raw material for high fructose corn syrup or corn-fed confinement-raised meat.
So it's not the sweet stuff you get on farm stands.
No, no, certainly not. It's in many ways what we discovered in King Corn was that cheap corn subsidized by taxpayer money through this subsidy system that rewards a kind of all-out production, oftentimes whether or not the market demands it. That cheap corn makes the raw materials readily available and abundant and affordable and cheap for the fast food economy that we live in.
And as I recall, the enterprise was not profitable without government subsidies, right?
No, the year we grew our acre of corn, the typical farmer in Iowa on the typical acre of land...
Which is some of the most productive land in the world.
Oh, it's I can't think of a better place to grow food of any kind. But the typical farmer on the typical acre of land lost money in that year other than for the government subsidy. And that's been true for many of the years out of the last 40 years that we've had this subsidy system in place.
And this is a model that requires us of vast inputs of chemicals and machinery.
Right. And that's honestly the part of the story we didn't get a chance to dig into in King Corn as much as we'd like to. I remember when we left Iowa, I had a kind of pit in my stomach that maybe we had only told half of the story. And in following the food that had left our farm, we had ignored something at least as important, which is the way we grew that food.
We'll get to that in a moment. But the corn that you did grow and many other people in Iowa grow goes to mostly animal feed and high fructose corn syrup, which is what makes a lot of people fat and unhealthy, right?
Well, it certainly contributes. You know, we were growing an unbelievable amount of food. We grew almost 10,000 pounds of corn, but it was pretty low.
On an acre?
On 1 acre, yeah. And the typical farm now out there is, oftentimes 1,000 acres. So on our 1 acre farm, we grew enough corn to fatten the meat for 4,000 corn-fed hamburgers or to sweeten 57,000 cans of soda.
And this high fructose corn syrup has replaced sugar in most confections, right?
Well, part of it is that it has replaced some of the sugar we used to eat, but even more troublingly, it has added to the total amount of sweetener we consume. So the amount of table sugar we eat has dropped just modestly over the last 30 or 40 years since high fructose corn syrup came on the market, but the amount of overall sweetness in our diet, the calories coming from sugar, has gone up quite dramatically.
And important to underscore, with heavy government subsidies.
And with government subsidies. Really, since the 70s, we've been rewarding farmers to grow more and more and more and more corn. And in many ways, we've been disincentivizing the growing of healthy, fresh fruits and vegetables.
And the more they grow, the lower the price, the more they need subsidies. So it's really an unhealthy circle of economic circle.
We've been spiraling in a kind of crazy direction for a long time. And what's interesting is from a food perspective, there's some real momentum finally to reform that system. According to the government's own statistics over in the CDC building, they've found that 1 in 3 kids born in the year 2000 is on track to develop type 2 diabetes during their lifetimes.
Which, of course, is unprecedented. This level of childhood adolescent diabetes.
Absolutely unprecedented, and in many ways it's hitting less affluent communities harder.
Okay, now this brings us to Big River. You open the movie with the scenes of a big flooding that happened in Iowa around the area you were growing your corn in. When was that, last year?
Yeah, just before, 2007.
2007, and you got curious about what was in all that water, right?
We did. Looking at our cornfield with this sea of water all around it, made us rethink what we had done to that acre of land. In King Corn, we spent so much of our energy trying to imagine what our cornfield had produced in terms of food, and yet we totally overlooked all of the water that had washed off of our acre of land and the things it was carrying with it, the chemicals we had applied, the topsoil we had plowed, the fertilizer we had injected. We really were sending downstream an incredible series of stories from our year of growing corn.
One of the things that struck me that you cover in the film is that the plowing of the land is unusual. I mean, in the history of human relation with nature. This used to be prairie grass, and now it gets cleared out for most of the year, right? What are the consequences of that?
You know, we've only had plows for a very short period of human history, and they've revolutionized the way in which we get our food, and by extension, the way in which we treat the landscape. If you drive across the country now and look out the window on either side of the car for days at a time, you will pass land that once was prairie, but now is plowed up twice a year, year after year after year, to plant annual crops for agriculture, crops like corn and soybeans. And the result of that plowing is that it makes the soil very fragile and highly erodible. And so Iowa has lost half of its topsoil in a little over 100 years of farming to wind and water that has carried away the precious mantle of fertility that sits on top of the earth that really is, at the end of the day, what all of us depend on to eat.
And that also has effects on the carbon cycle and the climate change, right?
It does, right. It's a little known and little understood major player in the climate change question. When you plow soil, you release carbon that was tied up in the soil, sequestered in the soil. And that carbon can go into the atmosphere again and contribute to being a warming gas. Under a prairie system, or under a system where the soil is actually building fertility, building soil carbon, then you can store more and more carbon and pull it out of the atmosphere. I mean, that's what makes plants amazing. They take atmospheric carbon dioxide and they create food for us and they give off oxygen. But every time we take out those plants and we plow that soil, we're contributing to global warming.
And also by increasing erodibility, is that a word? We're aiding the movement of all these chemicals into groundwater and river water and ocean water. Right.
Right. So when those soil particles leave the farms and fields of the Midwest, they carry with them residue from the pesticides that have been applied and residues of the fertilizers that have been injected or applied to that land as well. And that stuff winds up very often in rivers and then distributes itself through the streams and starts heading downriver.
And give us an idea of just what all this stuff is. What did you spray with, and what does it end up as?
We grew a fairly typical acre of Iowa corn, and the first thing we did before we planted our field was we injected 130 pounds of anhydrous ammonia fertilizer, and that came from a factory. We visited one factory that it might well have come from in western Iowa, and learned there that to make just the fertilizer for one application on our one-acre tiny field required the burning of 2,000 cubic feet of natural gas. Really incredible fossil fuel use that goes into making fertilizer available. That fertilizer also is a product called anhydrous ammonia, anhydrous meaning without water.
Which is nasty stuff if you breathe it in enclosed space.
Yeah, well, it makes the field smell like bathroom cleaner, which was kind of a crazy experience for an urban guy like me. I'm familiar with bathroom cleaner, but
that's not what nature is supposed to smell like.
I didn't think so. So we injected this fertilizer, but anhydrous ammonia, having had the water pulled out of it, tries desperately to reconnect with water when it gets a chance. So if it rains after you apply the fertilizer, you can lose up to half of what you put on the field, and it latches onto the water and heads toward the streams and rivers.
And what does it do when it gets there?
Well, in the case of our anhydrous ammonia, it ends up in a series of streams that head toward the Mississippi. And along the way, the communities in Iowa that have to drink the water that comes out of the surface rivers have a very serious problem to deal with, which is they have to remove that excess fertilizer, that nitrogen and the phosphate, from the drinking water before they can eat it. So,
and you show the Des Moines water authorities with the world's largest nitrate removal system.
Yeah, the city of Des Moines has the world's largest nitrate removal facility.
Not a big city, but...
No, but there's a lot of fertilizer in that water.
And this is a nice setup for a little bit of sound that I've got, which is all these nitrates find their way to the Mississippi and then into the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah, the film takes place with a series of flashbacks to the things we did on our one-acre farm, the fertilizer or the pesticides or the plowing. But then most of the film itself takes place in a journey down the river system by canoe that leads us eventually to the bottom of the Mississippi River and the Gulf of Mexico.
All right, let's play a little bit of that, 3 minutes or so of that.
We followed the nitrates in the river, which in peak season reach almost 8 million pounds a day, to the Gulf of Mexico and a part of the coastline called the Dead Zone.
Well, we're in Cocodrie, Louisiana. What affects the Gulf of Mexico is the dissolved nutrients, the dissolved organic nitrogen and the nitrate and the phosphate. And what's happened in the Gulf of Mexico is that the amount of nutrients has increased to the point that the algae are growing more than they did historically. So you end up with a deficit of oxygen on the bottom. And that's what happens in the Gulf. If there's not enough oxygen, a fish can't live. You won't see crabs, snails. You won't see any shrimp. You won't see any redfish. You won't see any red snapper. You won't see any stingrays. You won't see any sharks.
Yeah, that's probably why we ain't catching good shrimp no more, because of the dead zone.
Can you see it in the water?
The water's like a red color, you know, when you pull it.
A red color.
Red color, dead. When you pull through it, the fish and the shrimp are all dead in it. We working for nothing.
In communities along the Gulf Coast, bringing in an abundant catch of shrimp is as important culturally and economically as a 200 bushel corn harvest is in the Midwest. Delegations of shrimp fishermen have begun traveling to Iowa to meet with farmers and encourage them to use less fertilizer.
One farmer told me that he yielded 400 bushels of corn to an acre in Iowa. I asked him, why did he have to do that? He said, to use less land and produce more corn. What we're trying to say to the farmers is, if you have to survive, if you have to yield so much corn to the acre, fine. We got to find out a way that we can both survive. You're passing down your environmental problems down to me.
Where the Mississippi emptied into the Gulf, we could see the legacy our abundant cornfield had sent downriver. Above water, millions of pounds of grain were leaving America for export. But below the surface, that food had other costs.
And that was about 3 minutes of sound from the film Big River. And we've got one of the creators of that film in the studio here with us, Kurt Ellis. And who are your partners again?
That was Ian Chaney, who we were listening to giving the voiceover. And behind the camera and certainly invisible on the radio was Aaron Wolf, who is one of the producers.
And these pesticides are not only toxic to the fish in the Gulf of Mexico and to the livelihoods of the fishermen who had been living on that catch, but to the farmers too, right? The wife of the guy whose farm you were farming on died between the filming of the two movies, right?
Right. Really, in the Gulf of Mexico, the main problem is the nitrogen and phosphate fertilizers that flood down the river and create this giant dead zone where no fish can survive, an area the size of New Jersey oftentimes when the spring rains come about. But back up at our acre of corn, there was a much more personal story unfolding, which was our landlord's wife on our farm was diagnosed with a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma that is a disease that a number of farm women in the area have. And there's research going on about this cancer cluster of farm wives who are suffering from a disease that has been very closely tied to long-term exposure to agricultural chemicals, herbicides and pesticides like the ones we sprayed on our acre.
Yeah, all the people who shop at Whole Foods worry about the risks of chemicals themselves, but there's really very much more intense risk to the people who work on the farms and live around them.
Absolutely. And, you know, it affects not just the corn farmers in Iowa who are spraying for several months out of the year on their corn and soybean fields, but also the men and women who grow and tend the grapes we eat that are coming out of South America, the produce we get from California. Really, all the food we eat is at the end of the day grown by human hands and human beings who are, because of the choices we make at the grocery store and the choices we make in our advocacy and in our policy, those people are affected and exposed to incredible amounts of toxic chemicals.
And we're running low on time, but you don't really cover this in the film, but are there ways to do this differently? Can you do this more cleanly without grossly sacrificing productivity?
Very much so. I mean, from a consumer perspective, buying organic food and shopping at a farmer's market and asking your farmers directly how they grow things is a good start. But the very important next step is to advocate for change in Washington, D.C., for the expansion of a green payments program under the Conservation Security Program that would reward farmers not for this kind of all-out production mentality that we have in place today, but would instead reward them for good conservation practices, setting land aside adjacent to streams and rivers, not farming the steepest slopes and the most erodible lands, and using fewer chemicals when they're able to.
And are there any groups that are doing good work along these lines that people should check out?
Yeah, the best one to check out is the Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, also Food Democracy Now!, Practical Farmers of Iowa, and our own website, bigriverfilm.com, is a good clearinghouse for some of these places. You can learn more about the film, watch a trailer, buy a DVD, or sign up to host a community screening of the film there.
Which leads to my next question. This is screening around the country?
It is, yeah. We're setting up, looks like about 100 screenings by the time we're done this fall and winter. I was just at one last night in Minneapolis with 550 people in the audience and tremendous energy and enthusiasm. So it's very exciting to see the momentum that's building around rethinking our the kind of hidden costs of our food and agriculture system, many of which are ecological.
And people who are interested in sponsoring either a home or a public screening can do that on your website, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Just click on the Host a Screenings tab.
And that website again?
BigRiverFilm.com.
And what's up with King Korn? Is that still in circulation?
It is, yeah. King Korn is fairly widely in circulation in video rental stores or on Netflix or iTunes. We have a two-disc set with Big River and King Korn both available through that same website, BigRiverFilm.com.
And I got to say, they're both very fine films and not as earnest and dull as so many documentaries are. Really serious material, but still very entertaining to watch. So congratulations and thanks for this important work. I'm speaking with Kurt Ellis, who is one of the creators of Big River and its earlier companion, King Korn. You can check both of those out on the web and get King Korn on Netflix and all over the place, and I highly recommend doing that. Thanks for joining us, Kurt.
Thank you.
And let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about Israel and Utopia.
Bonjour, ici Léa Kayata et vous écoutez WBAI New York 99.5 FM et sur WBAI.org.
Wow, I don't know if that counts as, well, I guess you don't really need a legal ID at the half hour, but this is WBAI on 99.5 FM and also on the web at WBAI.org. And if you visit that website, please click the donate button and help us out because we need all the help we can get. My name is Doug Henwood, the program behind the news, and let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with Joel Shalit to talk about Israel versus Utopia. And that was some of Bach's Partita for Solo Flute, performed the first movement, performed by Jean-Pierre Rampal. And now we're joined in the studio by Joel Shalit, who is a busy author and editor. And his most recent book is called Israel versus Utopia, just out from Akashic Books. And welcome to Behind the News, Joel.
Glad to be here.
Israel versus Utopia. Actually, we did a little chat the other night at the McNally Jackson Bookstore, but I didn't get to ask you about the title.
It's a quadruple entendre, really. The title came about during the height of Operation Defensive Shield in April or May 2002, when I first began thinking about working on this book, especially as I was able to discern that the mainstream opinions towards Israel were beginning to change in the United States quite dramatically, particularly in view of the civilian casualties on the Palestinian side taking place during that time, especially following the combat in Jenin, in which there were allegations that the IDF massacred the inhabitants of the Palestinian refugee camp, and there was a lot of disputation as to whether that actually took place. The idea being, of course, that Israel had turned into dystopia, but the persons leveling criticisms of Israel at the time came from, what seemed like utopia in comparison to what Israel had become, which was the United States.
You've got a lot of material in the book about the left critique of Israel, a lot of which focuses on the word apartheid.
Yes.
What is your problem with the application of that concept to Israeli society?
I think as a whole, the term is, what I argue in the book is that the term is really mostly appropriate exclusively to the occupied territories, and that the situation of Palestinians living within Israel proper, while unambiguously discriminatory, is far more subtle and nuanced than the original meaning of the word as it was defined in South Africa, simply as separation.
To a lot of people, I think the appeal of the term is that there's a rigid system of population control, one dominant portion of the population, one very subordinated portion of the population, movements very tightly controlled, territory very tightly controlled. How then is, what's wrong with that parallel?
The parallel is that it's only half the story, and it tends to ignore the plight of Palestinians living within Israel proper, whose situation is far more nuanced than that of the Palestinians living under what seems like a more formal traditional practice of apartheid in the occupied territories. The critique that I level in the book of the way the term is practiced is precisely for those reasons, that it's oftentimes invoked to describe the situation of Arabs living within both Israel proper and in the occupied territories, when in fact there are differences in the discrimination that they are subject to, and that perhaps we might want to think of new words and new language to describe the totality of the racist practices and discrimination that they are subject to as a whole. It seems as though progressives continually oversimplify the experiences of Palestinian Israelis.
What's being missed in that experience?
The fact that they are substantively discriminated against.
And what share of the population of Israel?
20% at least.
Yeah. And growing more rapidly, much to the anxiety of a lot of Zionists.
There are a lot of right-wing Israelis who would, who have proposed in recent years to transfer their populations to what would become an eventual Palestinian state or to Jordan. And the plight of Palestinian Israelis needs to be better understood, better emphasized, and better put into perspective, because as some critics of their treatment have argued, there are facets of their treatment living within what is supposed to be a democratic state, where they are provided with ostensibly on paper equal rights, which may be learned from in terms of discriminatory practices in other Western states that are formal democracies as well.
Oh, but now a lot of non-Jews, for example, have restricted access to owning property in Israel, right?
That's right.
So it's the nature of, I don't know what you call it. What exactly is it? It's not exactly a theocracy, but
it approximates an ethnocracy.
What about a concept of citizenship? Is there some notion of Israeli citizenship?
Citizenship is granted to persons who can be correctly identified by, you know, largely Orthodox religious standards as Jews.
But most of the citizens of Israel are not Orthodox Jews, right?
No, of course not. And
so how does that work?
The standards applied to defining their citizenship has increasingly been determined by Orthodox religious authorities. That doesn't necessarily mean that all Israelis are Orthodox, all quote-unquote, you know, legitimate Israeli citizens are Orthodox Jews, but that standards from the Orthodox tradition are used to define what constitutes legitimate Israeli citizenship at this point in time. And a lot of Israelis are very uncomfortable with that. It's a source of immense discontent, even on the right, where there is a lot of complaining about what the after effects of this discourse is, even by members of Avigdor Lieberman's own party, Israel Beitenu, the paradigmatic right-wing racist party of the moment.
How did the Orthodox get to be in this position of determining so much when they're a small portion of the population?
Israel has two legal systems. One is secular and one is religious. And the secular system of justice is supposed to be superior to that of the religious courts. It should have jurisdiction over the religious courts, but the religious courts have their own larger cultural influence, which transcends their immediate legal responsibilities to religious members of the Jewish community. There's been a lot of discourse about this over the years, and obviously a lot of critics of the role of religion in Israeli public life have argued that when the state was founded, the role of religion in the Israeli state was not taken seriously enough by the founders of the state. And
who were pretty secular people for the most part, right?
They're very secular people, and many would argue didn't understand religion at all, including what was religious about their own political positions and general worldview.
There's also a very complicated relationship between Israel and the United States. The United States sends Israel a lot of money, a lot of people, a lot of weapons. But there's also some sort of affinity at the level of a political fantasy. Like, these are both countries that were founded on a mission, on an idea, and with large numbers of indigenous people removed in the creation of the states, and a myth-making that the land was empty when the settlers got there, right?
Yeah.
So how does this this kind of, you know, this phantasmic brotherhood work out in practice?
Oh, it's, you know, over the last 8 years since the beginning of the War on Terror, on September 11th, 2001, there's been an increasing criticism of Israeli-American relations for a variety of reasons. Some of them have to do with the consequences of America's alignment with Israel for American interests in the Middle East. And some of this criticism also comes from Israelis who increasingly regard Israel, these are particularly progressives, who are very uncomfortable with the notion that whatever affinities exist between Israel and the United States are invoked only insofar as these arguments can be used to further convince Israelis and diaspora Jews that Israel ought to serve instrumental purposes on behalf of the United States in the Middle East.
Yeah, which puts that the relationship there are a lot of critics of the U.S.-Israel relation that treats the United States as a kind of pawn of Israel. That Congress, as they like to say, is Israeli-occupied territory.
And what I argue in the book is that, in fact, the relationship, even though there is manipulation that takes place on both sides, as progressives, we need to remember that Israel is still a subordinate party, irrespective of how they try to influence American foreign policy as an ally of the United States.
And an important regional ally for the United States in the Middle East to do a lot of dirty work.
Yes, yes. And what I criticize quite heavily is the continuing notion within Israel proper that it ought to feel obligated to carry out those tasks on behalf of the United States, and that this has been this has had horrible consequences for Israeli politics and Israeli culture over the last 40 plus years since the Six-Day War, following which the alliance between the United States and Israel became formalized to the degree that it exists today.
Yeah, from a distance, I've never been to Israel, but from a distance, it looks like a very paranoid and hyper-militarized society. That can't be a terribly happy place.
It's not. Look at all the Israelis that live in New York. They're not just living here in Manhattan because the food is better, you know. there are a lot of Israelis who live in the United States and who live in Europe precisely because they want to escape the stress of living in Israeli society. They're not necessarily rejecting. There are things that many of these Israelis still love about Israeli society and Mediterranean Jewish culture, everything except the politics. And I think the Israeli diaspora in the United States and in Europe will continue to grow in relation to the continually disintegrating political situation in Israel today.
I'm speaking with Joel Shalit, author of the book Israel versus Utopia, just out from Akashic Books. And when you were on the show a couple of years ago, you said something which I thought was rather striking, that Israel needs this state of war and this paranoid sense of having so many external enemies, because otherwise the society would have to focus on its own internal contradictions. Could you talk about that some?
Yeah, of course. There seems to be a very impoverished sensibility amongst Israel's political echelon about how to derive a sense of national raison d'être, you know, of self-worth and of purpose, apart from that granted to it by the intense militarization of the country that has characterized Israeli politics, since the country's founding. It appears as though the only way that the country's political elite can define the country is in opposition to or because of a threat emanating from external sources. It's as though all of the quote-unquote, you know, positive qualities ascribed to Israel over the decades, both ascribed to Israel by itself as well as those who appreciate the country, paled in comparison to the necessity of external threats legitimating the country's existence. So, you know, no more kibbutzim, no more socialism, no more feminism, no more equality, no more religious freedom. The only thing that ever matters is the necessity of external threats to define the country as it exists, which I think has, as an ethos, has become more and more important over the years as all of the utopian traditions and egalitarian ethi that once were ascribed to the country by its founders and by its supporters and by Israelis themselves have disappeared under the weight of rising militarism and of the introduction of free market economics in the country over the last 20 years since the end of the Cold War.
Yeah, I think a lot of people here don't appreciate what a paradise of neoliberalism it's become.
It's yes, Israel is the most neoliberal state in the Middle East.
And there is a waning of attachment among a lot of younger American Jews to Israel, right? I mean, there seems to be a lot of younger American Jews don't share the interest in and attachment to the country that their parents and grandparents did.
That's correct. There is much evidence to show that American Jewish interest in Israel is designated more by the kind of religious affiliation one has in the Jewish community rather than this interest being driven by a sense of general Jewish solidarity and sense of cultural rootedness in the Middle East. You know, so for example, it's more common to find Zionist sentiments among persons who are fairly religious and fairly right-wing these days in the United States, rather than
and not always Jewish. A lot of Christians.
This is an interfaith problem. liberal political sentiment in the Jewish community and pro-Israel politics have been diverging for a long time, probably since at least, you know, I'm only 42 years old, but I have seen it. I have seen this trend develop and blossom now since the early 1980s.
When did the Christian right develop its love affair with Israel?
You began to see pro-Israel opinions being espoused by leaders of the Christian right beginning in the early 70s, following the 1967 victory, really. But Pat Robertson was a very early supporter of Israel, and so is Billy Graham. And I remember, I'm a collector of vintage spoken word vinyl, and when I was in San Francisco this summer, I picked up an album of recordings of Christian talk shows from the early 70s, and there was maybe 1974, there was a recording of Yitzhak Rabin on a talk show hosted by Pat Robertson, talking about Israel's merits, and I thought that was fascinating.
Wow, I didn't realize it went back that far.
I think that the 1967 war.
Well, it showed that Israel could kick ass.
It certainly did, but I think it also was. We don't always appreciate the extent of its religious significance for evangelical Christians as much as we understand it for Jews. And I think that...
What does it mean to them?
Now that Jews were in possession of all of the holy sites, holy places, it could, you know, help set a context for the return of the Messiah, as is more fully understood when people talk today about the necessity of Jewish control of the holy sites in Christian Zionist theology.
This is just another sign the end times are coming.
Absolutely, and the ingathering of exiles, i.e. the construction of the State of Israel and the flow of Jews to Israel, will ultimately signify the destruction of the Jewish people and the return of the Moshiach or the Messiah. How are that?
It always struck me these are people who like Israel but don't particularly like Jews.
That's correct. They see Israel instrumentally as a way to, in very anti-Semitic terms, as a means to the final and really legitimate end of the Jewish people.
And right now, some of the more paranoid attentions in Israel and also in the American right are directed towards Iran. What's going on with the relation, the Israel-Iran relation?
It's very complicated. Iran is both an external and threat and an ideological opportunity for Israel. It is an external threat in the sense that it supports and it finances and arms three of Israel's enemies, quote unquote, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Syrians, and Hamas, the Sunni Palestinian resistance organization that governs the Gaza Strip at present. The Iranian threat has escalated towards Israel in very profound ways in recent years, largely as a consequence of the American occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. And the Iranians very much understand that the more pressure they place on Israel, at least this is their belief, the more likely they are to get Washington's attention. They see Israel as the best and most convenient road to Washington, particularly given the threat that they feel emanating from Washington and its increased presence in the Middle East. Similarly, Iran, as a quote-unquote radical revolutionary Islamic regime, helps make the case for a continued militant posture by Israel towards the Islamic State and towards the outside Arab world, and it also helps reinforce the notion that Israel is of immense value to the West precisely because it is secular and it is democratic, at least in comparison to the extremity of Iran's self-representation or Iran's depiction to the West.
Although the combination of theocracy and democracy in Iran is not totally unlike that in Israel.
They have more in common. In some respects, they have more in common either side would like to admit. They're both extremely traumatized societies that react very irrationally to their neighbors. People oftentimes forget when you listen to the severity of Ahmadinejad's horrifically anti-Semitic rhetoric that Iran suffered millions of casualties during the Iran-Iraq war and has been repeatedly invaded by the outside world and is obviously the kind of society that at least its political elites are more likely to act out in more pathological ways than not, at least in terms of their purpose of expression.
I've only got a minute left. I'm sorry to do this.
Yes.
But is there any hope for Israel chilling out a little bit?
The more crisis-ridden the region becomes, the more opportunities present the West for more effectively intervening in the Arab-Israeli conflict. I've yet to see that happen, but there's never been a better opportunity for the West to do so at present.
And what about internally in Israel?
I'm not sure that the left is sufficiently organized to be able to wield the kind of political power that would at least internally make that difference right now.
And what are the odds of an attack on Iran coming anytime soon?
In Haaretz, the day before yesterday, Aluf Ben, one of their senior political correspondents, argued that or explained that that as far as Israel's prime minister is concerned, a war with Iran and Hezbollah are coming in the spring.
Well, that's a rather frightening note to end on.
Yeah.
But thank you for joining us, Joel Shalit. Joel is the author of Israel versus Utopia, just out from Akashic Books, and it's a very fine and thoughtful book, and also will fuel your taste for hummus. Okay.
Thank you, Doug.
I do have to get out of here a little early today because of the accursed candidate statements. That's it for me, Doug Hinwood. Stay tuned for the news. I'll be back next week, and let's go out with a little bit of this from Sophie Ellis Bextor. You got kind of like a song sung by a model that begins with a quote from Emma Goldman. Till next week. Bye.